up. Okay, folks, we're going to get back underway here in a moment. Go ahead, Stan. All right, let's resume the council meeting, please, and let's read the next item, please, Carla.
Item 366, accept report on the Arts Education and Access Fund by the Arts Oversight Committee.
Thank you, and I'm going to call up a panel here in a moment, but first, because of a technical or Scrivener's error, we need to amend the report by putting the replacement narrative on the table in front of the council.
So moved.
Is there a second for that motion?
Second.
So let's just take a roll call to have the replacement version of the narrative in front of us, and that's what we'll have the hearing on.
Fish?
Aye.
Novick?
Aye.
Fritz?
Aye.
Hales?
Aye.
Could you just tell me what the difference between the two is?
Yes.
Trusted you to vote yes.
It was, well, actually, I'll let Stan do that, because all I have is an indication that they have corrected the mistakes, but not what they were. So we'll let staff or Stan do that when they come up. So let me call up, please, Stan Pinkin, Alina Harway, Craig Gibbons, and Jim Cox. I believe all four of you are here. And we do have four chairs, so come on up and welcome our representatives of our committee, chaired by Mr. Pinkin.
Wow. Those are a lot of hard acts to follow.
Yeah, so no kidding.
We will do our best.
We have to talk about taxes and money after that.
Yep, all of that good stuff. To answer your question, Amanda, that was the version that you got just now is actually version 12. It's the 12th and final draft. And we were tweaking it up to the very last moment. So the difference in this one and what you got previously are really minor tweaks. There's nothing... No substantive changes to it.
More like grammatical changes.
Grammatical and just a couple of typos and
thank you.
Very, very minor.
Tables
thank
are essentially the same, I think. So, yeah, the numbers are the same. I mean, okay.
So, good afternoon, Mayor Hales and commissioners. My name is Stan Pinkin, and I am the chair of the Arts Education and Access Fund Citizen Oversight Committee. We're pleased to be here today to present the committee's first annual report on the Arts Tax Fund. Our report will consist of five parts and will be presented by myself and three other committee members here before you, Jim Cox, Craig Gibbons, and Alina Harway. We hope to present this report in as timely a manner as possible and are happy to take your questions upon its conclusion. Before getting into the body of the report, however, we want to share with you a brief video that is just one example of how the Arts Tax Fund in a very short period of time has had a positive impact on our children. Because of the fund, the Park Rose School District was able to hire three additional full-time music teachers. This is the result.
Everybody read it with me, ready? We are the music makers and the
bucket of water
for my oldest daughter.
We've got one in the bunch and three out the bunch.
I hope that was a worthy follow-up act. So before getting to the crux of the report and all the numbers and everything that I think everybody's anxious to see, I would just like to provide a little background and context. The committee was charged with reviewing the expenditures, progress, and outcomes of the fund and reporting their findings to the City Council on an annual basis. A group of 20 diverse and committed citizens came together amidst the uncertainty of lawsuits and controversy over the new arts tax, in an effort to get down to business in fulfilling its task of overseeing the integrity of the system and to ensure that taxpayer money was being collected, distributed, and utilized as intended by the voters. To that end, the Arts Oversight Committee, or AOC as we affectionately call it, set out to establish guidelines by which it would perform its tasks. Through the work of subcommittees and ultimate consensus by the full committee, we developed two important documents. One, we developed an AOC working agreement, which you will see in Appendix A. This is a document that established the process and guidelines for the group's ongoing work and for the committee's work in future years. Second document, very important, we developed a set of uniform metrics, which you will see in Appendix B, and we'll get into more detail on that when we get into the school report. This was a metric by which school and revenue bureau data would be requested and submitted to the committee for review and evaluation. A little bit more about the committee. The adopted city code stipulated that the Citizen Oversight Committee shall be representative of the city's diverse communities, consists of a minimum of 10 and a maximum of 20 members. The committee started out with a maximum of 20 in an effort to represent as broad a spectrum of the community as possible. During the course of its first year, the committee lost 8 members for a variety of reasons. Unfortunately, of those resignations, 5 were members of the Afro-American, Native American, and disabled communities. In an effort to again broaden the diversity of the committee, working with Jenny Caliz in Commissioner Fish's office and Josh Alpert in Mayor Hale's office, we have recently brought on 4 new members, one of whom you mentioned earlier, Commissioner Nick Carmen Dennison. The AOC and the city will continue its outreach. Just a little bit about our meetings and venues. The city code stated that the Citizen Oversight Committee was to meet at least twice annually. That was kind of a joke, actually. It would only be twice. We have far exceeded that requirement with a total of 18 full committee and subcommittee meetings since our inception. Our first meeting was in February of 2013. The early full committee meetings were held at city venues at the Portland Building and at the Revenue Bureau. We felt, however, that it was important to move its meetings across the city into different communities. The January meeting was held at the Park Row School District office, followed by the most recent April 1st meeting convened at the Centennial School District office. From day one, it has been the goal of the AOC to establish a partnering relationship with all those involved in the many aspects of the huge undertaking of the Arts Fund. The AOC wishes to acknowledge the help, guidance, and administrative support provided by the Revenue Bureau, led by Thomas Lanham and his dedicated staff, Kerry Williams, Barbara Rice, Megan Fertal, and Scott Carter. Noah Siegel, formerly of the mayor's office, was most instrumental in helping us to get off the ground in the early days. The AOC has been most fortunate to now have the coordination and liaison efforts of Jenny Caliz and Josh Alpert, for which we are grateful. We are thankful to Mayor Hales and Commissioner Fish for their support of our efforts. RAC has been an integral partner in our work, and we wish to thank Eloise Damrosch, Jeff Hawthorne, and Carol Smith for their valuable input. And that's Carol Smith from RAC, not the Carol Smith from PPS, to make that clear. We also want to thank Jessica Jarrett Miller, who is director of CAN, provided the committee with important background information. We further acknowledge the leadership of former Mayor Sam Adams, who was so instrumental in helping to create the fund. We furthermore truly appreciate the cooperation and collaboration of each of the six school districts who attended many of our meetings and offered input along the way. Although there are too many people to name individually, I want to acknowledge and thank my colleagues on the committee who worked so diligently this past year to help us reach this milestone. And if any of them are here, maybe you could just raise your hand. I know Gwen is here.
There's one.
Mark. Thank you. We would like to move on to report on the results and evaluations of the first year of the Arts Education and Access Fund and recommendations moving forward. So I will now turn this over to Jim, Craig, and Alina, who will report on revenue, schools, and RAC.
Thank you. Afternoon. The finances of this are really straightforward and simple, and of course this information is from the Revenue Bureau. And Mr. Lanham and Ms. Williams are here to correct anything I have wrong today. Net collections, and this is as of February 28th, were almost $8 million. And this is net collections after refunds. About $74,000 had to be refunded. There are some interest earnings there, and there then are the Revenue Bureau costs. The total or the net revenue that was dispersed was $7 million. Of that, $6.7 million went to schools, and RAC received $200. That was as of February 28th, and it left a balance of $112,000. As I understand it, most of that has been distributed to RAC between then and now. So that's the revenue and the disbursements. The next slide is a more detailed table of the disbursements. This shows the amount of money each school and RAC received as of the 28th and the percentage of the distribution. 65% for the Portland Public Schools and going down to 1% for Riverdale. RAC received 3% of the distributions, and that has increased since then. That's the math.
My name is Alina Harway. I'm the chair of the Metrics Committee, and I'm going to talk through our assessment of the school district's receipt and expenditure of the arts funds. The slide you have in front of you right now is the template that the Metrics Subcommittee designed and the full committee passed as far a frame of what we were going to ask the school districts and the revenue department to provide to us. We designed this template with two goals in mind. One was we needed the data to conduct our analysis for this year, this first year of the distribution, but we also wanted to begin collecting data that might be useful for future evaluations. So you can see that of the data points we asked of each of the school districts, we asked at the individual school level to let us know how many arts teachers they had overall by discipline, how many of those arts teachers were hired by the using arts fund money, how much of the arts funds money were used, what were their student populations. But then we also asked for general fund dollars at the district level as well as overall teacher staffing ratios. And that was, as I mentioned, to help the committee in future evaluations. We wanted to collect data that would allow the oversight committee to have contextual clues. When external variables start changing, we wanted the committee to be able to understand why that might have an impact on our assessments. So we sent this frame out to the school districts and asked them to fill it out for their K through 5 students and teachers, as well as a pared-down version for their middle and high school arts instruction. The reason for that, though the IGA, the intergovernmental agreement, did not specify funds for the middle and high school levels. It did state that the district should provide an articulated course of arts education throughout the student's career. So again, thinking about that future evaluation for the committee, we wanted to start compiling that data now. Each of the school districts took this template, filled it out for this current year as well as the previous year so we could have a base year. When we received the data from the school districts, we assigned one metrics subcommittee member for each school district to conduct a deep level analysis of that district as well as at the school level. That evaluation was then sent back to the full subcommittee and then to the full committee. We had conversations with the school, so we do believe this data has been very vetted. So that brings me to our findings. The slide in front of you now gives a snapshot of what we found across all of the Portland schools. Again, we did conduct this analysis at the district level and then going even further into looking at the ranges at the individual school level, and those evaluations are in your appendix. For the purposes of timeliness for today, we're looking more broadly across the spectrum. You have here in the left in blue last year as our base year of understanding how many arts teachers were provided to K through 5 students across each of the districts. You can see 2012 to 2013 school year, there were 31 and about a quarter arts teachers. This year, 2013 to 14, we see 75 FTE arts teachers. So the total number of arts teachers more than doubled from last year to this year.
So the base year is before the arts tax, right?
Yes. This was the first year that any of the districts received arts funds. We can also look at what kind of impact that's actually having on the students by looking at the student-teacher ratio, so understanding what does it mean when you add that many teachers based on what the school populations are. You can see that the average teacher to K-5 student ratio last year, before they received funds, was one arts teacher per 984 students. This year, it's decreased so that there's one arts teacher per every 453 students. A huge improvement. Certainly, there are ranges within the districts. You can see Riverdale's at the low end for one arts teacher per 100 students. Reynolds is at the high end, one arts teacher per 782 students. There were also ranges within the individual schools. And again, if you'd like to take a look at that, that is in your appendix. But for the most part, the committee found that these numbers, this hard data that we found here, as well as the testimony and the videos like you saw at the beginning of this presentation, left us very satisfied with our understanding that these arts funds were used by the school districts to improve arts education for their K-5 students.
May I ask questions as we go through, or would you rather I wait till the end?
Prefer, if you could wait, we'd prefer. Thank you.
We also looked at, it wasn't just did things improve, but we needed to look at the efficiency of these metrics. And so we were looking at the dollars spent and how they were spent and what sort of goals they got from those spendings. And this is where we really ran into questions. You'll see these questions laid out clearly in the report as well as recommendations we come from that, but I'll just do a little recap right now. We submitted an official request to the city to clarify some of the language in the IGA because we found that the understanding of what the intent of the language was has changed over the time from when our committee was formed till now. When we first formed, we were hearing from the public questions about whether the funds could be used to retain art teachers or whether it had to be to hire all new teachers on top of the previous year's budget. You probably heard that referred to as backfilling. So this was a current concern that was brought to us. We asked the city to weigh in on this and have gotten the official language to state what the arts funds could be used for. That current language now states that it may be used for hiring arts teachers and retaining arts teachers. It does clearly state in this most official language that we, or this most, the latest language we've received, the official language interpretation, that it may not be used for anything other than arts teachers. And that's important to note because we did see that Reynolds School District did use arts funds to pay for some arts experiences and arts materials. That interpretation was received earlier this month not because the city delayed in responding, but because our official request for that clarity didn't come until we were well into this process.
Arts includes music?
Yes, okay. And if you look in this page before, music, visual arts, drama, and dance. Another question was the goals that the schools were supposed to achieve. We knew that the revenue department was supposed to distribute funds based on a one arts teacher per 500 student framework. And that was intended to additionally be some sort of guideline for the schools, but it was not a steadfast number. You must achieve this 1 to 500. Or that's what we've learned in this the legal interpretation that we received this month. What we did learn on top of that is that the school districts are supposed to provide one FTE art teacher at every school. This is what we learned in this legal interpretation. Mm-hmm. We found that these goals were actually quite contradictory, because when you consider how wide of a range of student population you have across these schools, you can imagine a situation in which a district might, if they were going to adhere to the one full-time teacher at the school instead of, say, a half-time because the school population was small, it might mean they'd have to move arts instruction away from a larger public school. On the flip side, if the 1 to 500 ratio is a guideline, you have some schools that are much higher, have fewer arts teachers for their school population than the others. So this is just a long way to say this language seemed to cause great confusion among the public, the school administrators, the council. We have received this legal interpretation, and moving forward, it could be very easy to point back to it and say that's the official language here forward. But we know that the city and the schools are, you will be renewing your IGAs, and we would recommend to you that you consider clarifying and changing some of that language when you go to renew to provide very clear expectations of what the fund should be used for so there's no confusion moving forward, and potentially considering what voters maybe intended with the passage of the ballot measure in 2012. And we'd also recommend that you consider reframing the goals, since we find the one full-time equivalent arts teacher at each school and the 1 to 500 ratio guideline are not compatible. I'm going to turn things over to Jim. Happy to answer questions at the end.
All right. Thank you.
Great. So the second funding source from the Arts Fund is to provide general operating support and access and equity opportunities for Portland's nonprofit arts groups. These dollars are allocated after the schools are fully funded. So as Alina said, the funds were about $6.7 million was the base for the schools based on one teacher for 500 students. So you had to meet that before funds were allocated for Portland's nonprofit arts groups. Those funds are administered, as you heard earlier, from Eloise Damaros to RAC, the Regional Arts and Culture Council. And this year, RAC received $200,000 as of February 28th. Now, to put that in a little bit of perspective, when the arts fund tax was first brought to the public, some of the projections for what RAC would get out of this were up to $4 million. So there are some reasons in year one why we're seeing low collections for RAC, one of which is after the passage of the ballot measure. It was determined that there were certain taxpayers who didn't qualify to be assessed for that tax. So that brought the numbers down. Council also made an equity choice to basically say that certain taxpayers who have a low income threshold also didn't qualify for that tax fund of the $35 per person. So that also lowered the number of collections that there were. And finally, as of February 28th, the Revenue Bureau had yet to go after any non-filers for tax year 2012. So there may still be a fair pool of people that owe the tax for tax year 2012 that haven't paid it yet. That being said, $200,000 in January, very late actually, was distributed to RAC. And to RAC's credit, they were able to get that money out fairly quickly. As you heard in the presentation before, The majority of the funds that RAC receives are to go to provide funding, general operating support, for the major arts organizations, nonprofit arts organizations in the Portland area. There were 44 groups that RAC has previously vetted for funding that received money from a base before the tax of about $1.7 million. The additional $200,000 was then split based on the percentage of what these organizations got. So these 44 organizations received grants as small as $882 to the smallest ones, to as high as $22,138 for the Portland Art Museum, which is the largest grantee in that grant program. The reality is, in this year, that's going to have minimal impact to these organizations. An additional 5% of the tax funds that are provided to RAC are specifically used to promote access to arts programming. And what RAC did was they allocated $26,000. You saw this in the previous presentation, which is twice the amount of what they are stipulated to do, which is great. And what they did is they implemented rather quickly in February a competitive grant process for organizations that don't qualify for the general operating support but are doing programs that benefit underserved communities. And so we'll learn about that in May. That's when the grant program will announce which organizations receive those grants and what they'll be for. So we'll be able to report on that a year from now. RAC also uses a portion of these funds to coordinate arts education programs across the area. So they allocated of the $200,000, $13,000 to provide professional training for 26 arts specialists throughout the Portland area, and also supporting the city's participation in a program called Any Given Child, which is a partnership with the John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. And as of February 28th, there was an additional $10,924 that had yet to be allocated in the grant program. Now, all additional collections that the Revenue Bureau makes for tax year 2012, between now and when they're finished doing collections from non-filers, will go to RAC. So at the end of that, basically a year from now, we'll be able to have a fuller understanding and picture for you of what happened with the 2012 funds for RAC. What we have learned is that there has been another allocation made, I believe it was a week ago, of $125,000 from the Revenue Bureau to RAC. So we know that there's an additional $125,000 for RAC. So to give a few recommendations on this has been kind of a rocky start for RAC, partly because the distribution came so late. And I think also, this is also about trying to make sure that the arts organizations in the area are able to program and have a sense of, if they have additional funds, how can they actually provide additional access. It's very difficult for them to do if they don't know what the dollars coming in are expected. So we have some suggestions that we'd like to present to council for recommendations to help make this funding source a little more easy for the arts organizations to deal with, because most of these arts organizations are already planning for their next fiscal year, many of which begin on July 1st of 2014. So we'd like to recommend to council that they streamline and expedite the collection process with the Revenue Bureau, particularly ways that they can collect from non-filers. We'd also like to recommend that both council, RAC, and the Revenue Bureau come up with a reasonable estimate of funding for the tax year 2013 so that RAC can help articulate that to the nonprofit arts community, and also to work to get funds to RAC much earlier in the process instead of waiting to the beginning of the next calendar year so they can distribute those funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim, Craig, and Alina. There are a number of recommendations that you've just heard in the body of this report, but the following is a summary of our general recommendations. One, the city should be at the forefront of providing more positive messaging about the tax and its benefits for children, the arts, and the entire community. Two, although we realize that the first year of a new initiative can be confusing to the public, the Revenue Bureau and city leaders should seek ways to better communicate the arts tax requirements to the public, including more outreach to minority populations and expanding explanations in additional language, although there has been some effort to do so, even under cap constraints. We understand that administrative funds have been capped, but the city may need to explore ways to partner with other agencies to provide this important resource. 3, the Revenue Bureau should continue to work towards expediting its collection process in the future. Incorporating the arts tax into TurboTax and other third-party software and seeking file sharing with the IRS should be implemented as soon as possible. Also consider adding personnel to speed up collections and determine how that would affect the cap structure. Following up recommendation number 3, City Council and the Revenue Bureau should review the 5% cap and determine if it is in fact a realistic figure, especially in light of expected reduced revenue. Number 5, the Revenue Bureau should provide a 3-year projection of revenue and expenses after all the data is in for the first year, tax year 2012. I do want to add something about the Revenue Bureau, which is in our report. I'm just going to read this directly out of the report. It is our opinion that the Revenue Bureau, under a short startup time frame and with the subsequent issues and changes that took place, did an excellent job in pulling together its resources and implementing the collection process. The Bureau has been open and transparent and very responsive to questions and concerns from the committee. Back to the recommendations. Number 6, the IGA between the city and the school districts should have more specific language about how the funds should be spent and a clearer definition of costs. Language should also be included about the Citizen Oversight Committee's role and responsibility. Number 7, the AOC should be more insistent that all schools submit their data in the same format that was established by the committee and within the time frame that we had established. We recommend that the renewed IGA address this point. Finally, number 8, review the funding distribution calculations as relates to schools that already have excellent ratios and consider how this should impact further distributions to ensure arts access within the Portland area. So what's next about RAC? Much of our first year was focused on getting organized and fully understanding the workings of the arts tax as it was related to the schools. More recently, we have begun to dig deeper into the RAC side of the funding and will be further developing our evaluation procedures for the RAC portion of the fund distribution and creating a standard metric template for evaluations. About the IGAs, as mentioned, several questions arose regarding the intergovernmental agreements between the schools and the city. With renewal of the IGA scheduled for June 30th, 2014, the AOC will further review the current IGA for any additional suggestions we may have. A little bit about qualitative impacts. While our charge is to oversee and review the expenditures and outcomes of the arts tax fund, we strongly believe that our task goes beyond just a quantitative measuring. The word outcome in the code language is not fully defined, but we feel it should include a qualitative evaluation as well. Questions such as, what are the ultimate impacts on children? Are children doing better in school? Are children doing better socially? Do we see an effect on graduation rates? Do we see an effect on student attendance? Do we have qualified and diverse arts teachers, not just more teachers? Has there been an effect on parent involvement in the schools? Are our multicultural communities more engaged with the arts? Have arts institutions been able to open their doors to more underserved communities? These are more difficult questions to answer than simply evaluating numbers, but we believe these questions can be answered over time. With the first year now behind us, we will continue to review our methods of data collection and evaluations and make revisions as deemed appropriate. We remain open to input and suggestions from all sources. That is our report. Thank you very much. And we now open it up to any questions you might have.
Thank you.
questions.
Thank you. So going back to page 5 on the staff, the school district staffing results. Well, first of all, thank you all for your work. This is very high-level work, and I know from being copied on your emails that there's been a lot of behind-the-scenes work on it. So, and I haven't read them all. I will say that right up front. So maybe this has been answered, but I'm trying to understand this table. And it looks like that the cost of a teacher, at least in Park Rose, Portland Public Schools, and Riverdale, is about $100,000 per teacher, which seems reasonable with benefits and such. My questions are about, well, two of them. Park Rose, David Douglas, and Portland Public are all within the city of Portland. All the kids within those districts are within the city limits. How were the allocations made for the other districts that there are some kids from inside Portland and some from outside Portland?
Well, it's my understanding that the allocations were only made to those that were within the catchment of Portland itself. So I believe it was allocated according to that, to those populations.
So are these numbers only the kids, the ratio of Portland kids?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, okay. So then why, and I can see that in some ways, for instance, David Douglas has been rewarded for already funding 9.2 arts teachers before the arts tax, and they weren't penalized for that. They got $965,000, even though that was just one more teacher. So presumably they were then able to reallocate their resources. What's not clear to me is why Reynolds only has 2.5 arts teachers and yet received $357,000.
As we mentioned earlier, there were questions across several of the school districts about what the funds could be used for. And, you know, David Douglas, as you mentioned, you know, increased only a small amount. And in part, that was because they said they were going to use those funds to retain some of the arts teachers. So there's that question. With Reynolds, I mentioned earlier that some of the funds that they received, they used for arts experiences, so field trips and supplies.
But that's not my question. My question is, why did they get $357,000 in the first place when if they only had that many students, that they wouldn't get that much money? They've got disproportionately more money.
When you look at the amount of the district that's in the city.
Yeah, when you look at the numbers. And the same with, because the same with between Riverdale and Park Rose.
So are you looking at this chart? Yes, so this chart here is the ratio, the actual number of students.
Right, but if you multiply it out, you get the number of students, and it doesn't seem to match up with the funding allocation. Who determined the funding
that would be? I think that would be a question for revenue.
Curious.
The revenue did.
Waving your
okay.
hand there.
Yes,
so.
These are. I just want to clarify okay. that the numbers of the distribution and the school populations were numbers that we derived from revenue. And population numbers and average salary numbers is information that revenue, if I'm correct, derived from the Oregon Department of Education.
So
these are the numbers that we receive, and these are the numbers that
I
we
see.
Work with.
So you're just tracking what was the money used for and such,
yes.
rather than how did it get? Okay. And is the Revenue Bureau going to be presenting?
They're here and ready to answer questions, and Terry was waving her hand there. I think she's willing.
Great. Thank you very much.
Other questions for the committee members? Please?
Yeah. First of all, thank you for your work. It's very thorough, and sounds for your frequency of meetings, more than you may have anticipated, but we appreciate it. So I guess, and I'm sure Revenue Bureau can come up here and give a spiel too, but I want to ask you, the citizen members, I mean, intuitively to me, and I think a lot of citizens, it doesn't make sense that the 5% administrative cap should be increased if your revenue is declining. So can you answer that? I mean, I don't track that. Intuitively, it seems like if you're taking in less revenue, why should your administrative expenses be increasing?
Well, I think revenue can answer that better.
I'm sure they can.
But they have fixed administrative costs. Those costs aren't going to change that much, whether you're bringing in $12 million or $8 million. So as a percentage, that's the percentage is going to be different. And I think that it's just simple arithmetic.
I think also as you look across what nonprofit organizations spend in administrative costs and businesses spend in administrative costs, 5% is almost an unrealistic expectation to be able to do an administrative cost. So it was put out there to the voters, but we may need to look at and see, is it truly reasonable to run a program like this on only 5%?
So you know the children's levy, which was also put out to voters, does run and has run for 10 years now on a 5% administrative cap. So how do you think the public would react to knowing that on the one hand, and then on the other hand,
we
saying,
put it out to you, Counselor. It's just a
well, I mean, would you view it as a breach of faith with the public, who was
it may well
you
know, be
you
know,
as part of the campaign was way, yeah. told $35, 5% administrative cap. So.
Yeah, well, that may well be, but again, this was the first year.
Yeah.
It was very confusing. The devil was in the details, and when you get down, everything was very well intentioned, and everything was written and prescribed. But when you get down into the details and you start working with it, you start seeing flaws and places where things just maybe don't work that well and are maybe not realistic. It seemed to us, we worked very closely with revenue from the beginning, and we knew we could see the struggles that they had in trying to keep under that cap. And they were successful, I think, in doing it at least the first year. We don't know that it's realistic in the future, and all we're suggesting is that that's something that should be looked at, as well as looking at the IGA, looking at other language. After the first year, we think it requires a kind of a review of everything.
What administrative cost percentage is typical in nonprofits or in business organizations?
12% to 18%.
I've always thought that the children's levy's ability to stay within 5% must be the product of black magic, and I've been hesitant to inquire into it.
One thing I would add is we recommended maybe lifting the cap, but we also recommended maybe partnering with other agencies in order to fulfill the task that we thought maybe they weren't quite wrapping their arms fully around, like the outreach in other languages. So maybe that's something they could partner with the administration of the children's levy if they're able to communicate with the diverse communities in Portland and make sure they understand about it, then maybe revenue can hop on board with that.
And we're also leaving money on the table right now. As of now, as far as I know, revenue has not been able to go out after non-filers. So that may keep them under the cap, but they may be leaving a lot of money on the table for the tax.
Yeah, and that's kind of my second question I wanted to ask you. And I should have prefaced my remarks. You know, I may come across as being critical, but I supported referring the arts tax to the voters and supported it. But I feel this is my job, is to ask questions, as it's your job to oversee the implementation. So, and that gets to the non-filers. We had quite a robust debate about this before when the council was referring this. And I was probably the one that was, you know, leading the charge about not being too harsh on non-filers for $35 a year, for $70 a year, at the expense of people who, you know, barely scrape by on minimum wage jobs or slightly above minimum wage jobs, and the risk to their credit ratings for, as I said, maybe not paying $35 or $70. Not a lot of money, but a lot of damage that could be done to your credit history and your rental, your ability to rent and things like that. So I'm just curious, you're recommending sort of an accelerated collection effort. You talked about qualitative outcomes too, you know, being more qualitative. How do you be more qualitative about that aspect too, sort of that tension that still exists in my mind very much? I mean, I understand there's been a tremendous, revenue hasn't come in. I do believe that each year it's going to get better and better. People are going to file more. But, you know, at what point do you go after somebody for a small amount of money given the commensurate risk to their credit or rental histories?
Well, honestly, I don't think that's a question for us to answer. I think that's a question for City Council and the Revenue Bureau to answer. I personally had concern as well about the $35 and for those people who are right on the borderline and for whom that can mean putting dinner on the table. But I also look at the big picture and think about what this tax is doing. Just as you saw in the video, kids getting the opportunity to have an arts education, and that what that does to their creativity, for them to be able to be innovative, for them to be able to express themselves. I think there's a longer term a good that comes out of this that, quite honestly, has not been spoken about as much as it should have, certainly by the media over the past year or year and a half. And I think the big picture is something we have to look at and what that value is to our kids, especially in the underserved communities.
If I could just jump in on one point, because I think what I heard you say, Stan, is that you want us to look at this issue. You have not specifically recommended what mix of carrot or stick, but you're asking us, and having discussed this with you in the past, you've suggested, for example, that better communication with taxpayers will encourage a higher rate of participation. You mentioned in your testimony embedding this in TurboTax and working with accountants. Well, Jim, you're familiar with that because that's how we spread the word about the Oregon Cultural Trust tax credit. So there are carrots and ways of encouraging people to reach a higher level of voluntary compliance that you get to even before you start talking about stick. So what I read the recommendation is that we should be looking at a range of options, but focused on getting a higher compliance rate. Is that fair?
I think that's fair.
And to add to that, the Revenue Department has been very clear about what their collection process is going to be. And they have a very measured process in mind that is it's a balance between aggression and passivity. And I think it's an appropriate approach for this tax for right now.
One other thing you should know is that in an earlier hearing we had a couple of months ago, the mayor floated the idea of looking at all the ways we collect revenue across all the bureaus and systems and creating some uniform systems. So this is actually a bigger question than just this tax, because we collect water bills, we collect leaf fees, we collect all kinds of charges. And so council has to grapple with that in the larger context of how we interface with, you know, taxpayers and the public we serve, and how far we're willing to go to collect something. But again, I received the recommendation as flagging this and you urging us to work with the Revenue Bureau to look at a range of options. And Commissioner Saltzman has in the past expressed some concerns about, you know, harsh collection efforts, particularly against people that have a challenge in terms of paying. And I think that should be part of the discussion. But ultimately, I think you're saying you want us to have that discussion since we're in the position to do the enforcement. You're the citizen oversight body. So that's how I receive your recommendation.
Yeah, I get that. Okay. Other questions for this panel?
I have a question, Mayor. Sure. Mr. Chair, you mentioned having updated IGAs, and you've been working a lot on metrics. So what is the sense of the committee if we update the IGAs and we continue to refine the metrics, but you don't get the full cooperation you're looking for from any particular school district? Then what?
Well, if that would be the case, we then bring that to you to deal with. But I will say, and I think I mentioned it earlier in the report, that the schools have been very cooperative with us. And in some of our subcommittee metrics meetings, we had some of the school representatives with us. We talked about the metrics. We came up with the template, an earlier version of the template that you saw. We had input from them about some things that were not realistic, that they could not do or could not provide. So we've worked together to create that metric. Once we refine that metric in succeeding years, and if the school, hopefully we'll get the school's cooperation in our developing of these metrics or revising them, but if a school does not respond, we report that, as I understand it, we report that to you. We cannot tell the schools what to do. We can tell you that they're doing this or they're doing that, and that's I think, how we view it.
And finally, Stan, you've been at this a lot this year, and so do you have a sense, given the range of the size of the committee, what an optimal size committee is? What's the right size, given your experience?
Well, I'm generally not a believer in large committees because I think it's less intimate, and I think in a large committee, some people are more hesitant to speak up. But I think it is important that we have a diversity on this committee. And I typically would not be crazy about a 20-person committee. We are now at 16, and to me that feels kind of comfortable, and I think we've created a little more diversity that we've lost. So basically, I'm fine with where we're at, and I don't think it should be much smaller just because of the diversity component of it.
Good discussion. Thank you all very much. And we'll have you stand by in case we have other questions for you after we take public testimony, but I think we want to call Terry up and answer your question, Commissioner Fritz. So, Terry, you're on. You want to take testimony? I'm sorry, Terry. We'll take public testimony first and then bring you and Thomas up. Sorry. So let's go ahead and take whoever signed up.
We have three people signed up. Okay. Please come on up. Nancy Helmsworth, Mel Lindsay, and Chris Coleman.
Okay, come on up. Yes, please. Thanks for waiting.
Oh, thank you. Should I introduce myself? I'm Nancy
Just
Helmsworth.
Yeah, it's fine.
I'm a citizen in Multnomah County, and I'm one of the art teachers that was hired with Arts Tax, and I'm working for PPS. Set up right?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. The passage of the arts tax is making a significant difference in the lives of Portland students. As a career art teacher, I know, and we all understand, how having an opportunity to expand a student's experience and introduce him or her to new ways of thinking, seeing, and making is already enlarging and changing a student's life. Last fall, teachers hit the ground running. Principals scrambled to define classroom space and determine what and if there were materials budgets. Schedules were invented or resurrected from a time when specials existed. As a professionals we are, I think we did really well to get our programs up and running quickly. My teaching experience has been beyond my expectations in terms of student quality. Students are open and hungry to learn and succeed in this new venue. The strong students did great, the middle students did really well, and the lower students surprised themselves by being very successful in a concrete and tangible way. That is the cool thing about art. We make a product that everyone can see, and as professionals, we can lead students in a way and at a pace that promises frequent success. Anyway, we're still at the beginning, and since this is a nascent program, it is open to thoughtful development in terms of content, influence, and implementation. And we just had a big report about implementation. As I have listened to my colleagues, meaning my teaching colleagues, it is clear that some of the implementation will need to be addressed. And I am speaking for all of us art teachers in saying that we want our programs to run as smoothly and effectively and efficiently as possible, so we and, more importantly, our students can take full advantage of this learning opportunity. We are committed to doing our part to honor the mandate from the taxpayers and do our best to introduce the arts to the children of Portland. My request today is that we can open a door of dialogue to discuss ways that we can effectively and efficiently deliver our programs. I hope we can make time for some future conversations. I, for one, would like to be part of those discussions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks.
Hi. Good afternoon. I have to wait for them to reset that. I'm Mel Lindsay. I am a visual arts specialist at Metropolitan Learning Center. And I'd like to start by thanking the committee here today and the council and the Multnomah County voters, of course, for returning these vital arts programs to our elementary students. I am so thrilled to be returning to the visual art classroom. Our children missed us. With the reintroduction of the arts to our schools, we are embracing an opportunity not only to teach children about art as culture, as communication, and as self-expression, but to use the arts to collaborate across disciplines, to support Common Core standards and smarter balanced assessment, with the common goal of creating 21st century citizens. When I create clay monarch butterfly caterpillar models with my students, I'm collaborating to meet science goals. When my students create Northwest Coastal Tribal inspired totem poles, they use research-based inquiry, observation, and synthesization skills, all part of smarter, balanced learning strategies. When my students use emerging pre-geometry and fraction skills to create 12-part color wheels reflecting radial symmetry, they are reasoning and practicing complex, higher-level thinking. Finally, when my students write the artist statements that are required with every completed project, they are reflecting, describing processes, and evaluating personal artistic choices while practicing sequential writing skills. Art is important for 21st century kids, and I'm proud and excited to be part of the team bringing the arts back to Portland. We have hit a few bumps as we implement these exciting new programs. I know budgets for consumable materials are something that we need to find some workable solutions for. However, the bottom line, as you can see from our show downstairs, and I hope you all check it out, that art is elementary, and our kids are hungry to create and explore. Thanks for working with us on this exciting venture. I also have a parent statement that I can read in my minute and 4 seconds. It has been great to walk through the halls of Creative Science School this year, not my school, but another school, and see all the student work being displayed on the walls. Through the art tax funding, our students are being exposed to basic art education and art history on a regular basis. This is the first year that CSS has ever had an art teacher. I feel good paying my $35 this year, knowing that the money is well spent on hardworking arts teachers. That's from Leslie Tucker, a CSS parent. Also, just to reiterate, our show is downstairs for 1 week. Our reception is on the 30th. Art is elementary. K-5 Spring Showcase, showcasing the art of 25 elementary schools in Portland Public Schools. Much thanks to Susie Root and Nancy Helmsworth for helping put the show on and getting it up and running. It's a beautiful, beautiful show. Please check it out.
Thank you very much.
Hey, slide down a little bit.
I'm Chris Coleman, and I am the board chair of the Creative Advocacy Network, the organization that brought this measure to the ballot that is doing these wonderful things and has been such a pain in the butt of the commission and the mayor of the city. I'd like to address your concerns on the collections question, Commissioner Saltzman. So about 100,000, as I understand it, about 100,000 citizens have not yet paid the tax. And until February 28th, they had received no communication to that about what's going to happen if you don't pay it. So to my mind, that's 100,000 people who thought, okay, well, I got away with it. There's no ramifications for not paying that. If that had been collected, the entire disbursement that RAC was expecting to disseminate to arts organizations around the city would have been possible in this first cycle. And I don't think anybody is suggesting if you haven't paid $35, you get sent to a collections bureau, but you should at least get a letter saying, hey, you haven't paid this, and there's going to be some consequence if you don't in future. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Great. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Others?
That's all who signed up.
Okay. So thank you all. Thomas, Terry, come up, and let's address questions. So maybe you could start with that last point of what do we do next about, what do we know next about uncollected taxes?
Sure. Thank you. I'm Thomas Lanham. I'm the director of the Revenue Bureau, and this is Terry Williams, tax division manager. Where do you start? This is a brand new tax. It's $35 per person. There are 75,000 accounts per FTE that we have to manage this program. Just by way of a benchmark or contrast, on the business license side, one tax collector handles about 6,000 accounts. So we were right out there on the edge in terms of trying to implement new technologies, the IRS data sharing arrangement, as well as getting into third-party apps like TurboTax, really getting aggressive with trying to encourage people to file and pay online to the extent that they could. And many of those efforts are either well out of the gates or have been successful. About 40% of payments last year came in online, so we were very pleased to see that. Some of the early challenges were we had three deadlines last year, so our final deadline wasn't until June 10th. And then even after that deadline, it took many months to get all those tax returns in. Of course, then we had to start the refund process because there was a great deal of confusion and many people had filed and paid who might not have been expected to pay. So all of those refunds, every single person that paid, over 150,000 people that paid timely last year had to get an offer for a refund because if you pay this tax, we don't ask for any further identifying income information. So it's not possible for us to sort out who should or shouldn't have paid. So the refund process had to occur, and I could go on. In terms of the projections about $12 million, a great many voices were talking about $12 million in the run-up to the folks voting for this measure. I guess what I would say about that is the Revenue Bureau was not one of those voices. If you go back and you look at the 2012 documents we prepared and the 2013 update we did for the projection, we're right in the ballpark of what we said we would have at this point in time. So nobody wants to ensure that a tax is more fairly and honestly collected, aggressively but fairly, than my organization. Our credibility is at stake when it comes to making sure that people carry their water and that someone that pays doesn't have a lingering feeling that they really didn't have to pay because somebody else will carry their water for them. So we're doing everything that we can with the 4 FTE that we have. We do temporarily hire during this time of the year.